Hi, community. This is Trinelle.
And I'm Shara.
Hello, folks. This is Efrain, and this is Becoming the Vision. Our guest today is Brenda Solórzano. Yes, not Solórzano, Solórzano. She's the founding CEO of the Headwaters Foundation, and Brenda is also the incoming president and CEO of the California Endowment. I just feel, you know, after a conversation with Crystal, I can see so many connections, and I can see already a lot of what you're saying. I mean, the questions that they're asking and the things that they're saying are already in conversation. It's a beautiful thing to see that we continue to bring the people that are supposed to be here to have the right conversation that we're supposed to have. And it's just, I'm very excited. This was a wonderful second episode.
And women of color in philanthropy right now are hot. If you didn't know, now you know. First Crystal, now Brenda. This is a really beautiful episode and really a continuation of really hearing about what it takes and what it looks like to be more of who you really are in this work and why that matters so much for our desire to build just futures.
And Brenda, I just want to say that I personally have always felt, I've seen you around in conferences, and you're very vocal and very open. And I personally always felt I was always very intrigued by you. And I think when I was younger, I didn't really know why, other than knowing that we're both Latina immigrants. But I think there was an authenticity. There is a way in which you move and the way in which you present yourself that I was yearning, that I wanted to be that person. I just didn't know. I was still in that perfectionism. I have to be in these ways. And I was seeing you out there. So it is just such a joy and a very special moment for me to be with you in conversation. So thank you. Thank you for joining us.
Well, thank you for that, Efrain. I'm feeling the love and really excited about being in conversation and being able to share about authenticity.
I want to invite you just to tell us what might be a word that you're meditating on these days.
Well, the word that I've been meditating on lately is sparks. And it came to me because not that long ago, I was talking to a woman about the work that I do around trust-based philanthropy. And she said to me, Brenda, you're like blowing on the embers and creating sparks in the way that philanthropy works. And it just stuck with me. And so I've been thinking a lot about, am I really creating sparks? Am I the spark, or am I finding sparks? And where am I looking for those sparks? And what is happening with those sparks? And so it just became a word that I've been sitting with. And it also, I think it struck me because so often we look at the negativity in the world, the way that you were talking about, Efrain, of, you know, all the negative things that are happening, all the challenges and problems that we're seeing in the world today. And so the ability to shift from this negative frame to a more positive frame of sparks really hit me. And so that's the word I've been meditating. That's what I've been thinking about. And you know, I even went and I'm like, let's Google what comes up when you do meditating on sparks. And I actually found this this short exercise that is done by a woman named Samantha Snowden, who is with Headspace. You can Google it, and I'm sure you'll find it too. And it's just she describes it as a short meditation to spark joy. And so it snowballed, right? I started with spark, and now I'm like joy, and then like joy, the positivity. And so it just feels like it's a word that really is making me feel good about where I'm at and what's going on and how I'm perceiving my work and how I need to paradigm shift my frame so that I can stay in that positive space.
Well, hearing Efrain's opening anecdote about how you influenced him, I would say you're the air. You're the breath of fresh air, Brenda, right? Efrain was an ember in the audience, and you sparked something in him.
You know, it's funny because I never think about myself. And I think that's why when this woman shared, like, I'm blowing embers and creating sparks, that it really struck with me, because I've never thought about anything I do about myself or about my power. It's always been about people like my parents. And so it makes me, I think it makes me just stay in that space. And it's funny to me, like when people say, wow, Brenda, you're a CEO now. And I'm like, I never wanted to be a CEO. And I never wanted to be a CEO because I didn't see myself in that way. And I think as I've gotten older and more confident and comfortable in the space that of who I am, I've realized, I can be authentically me. I don't have to be that vision of what a CEO is supposed to look like, sound like, look like.
I think it really speaks to how when you lead with authenticity, you might open up space for other people to do the same, all right? Or start dreaming about doing the same. And so you are unknowingly participating in other folks' liberation. I think that's a really beautiful thing.
I appreciate that, Chanel. And I say it's hard, because the world around us is not set up for us to be our authentic selves. Mm-hmm. In fact, any of us who have gotten an education have been trained to talk a certain way, look a certain way, sound a certain way, and everything that is authentically who you are inside, your ethnicity, your culture, your gender, gets hidden and pushed down deep. And to be quote unquote successful in this world, it's not those things that are inside of you. It is those things that, you know, mainstream society says you need to be. So I think that there's always this tension that we're fighting between who am I authentically and what is the world saying I need to be? And the first part of my career, I was what the world wanted me to be. It's why I'm sitting in the CEO chair, to be honest with you. But as I've gotten older, I've realized that I gotta look at what are my core values of who I am? What is my culture? And how does that show up in who I am? And how do I find myself in that? And stop listening to those external things and really kind of listen to what's inside of me and where I come from. And I think when I finally realized that, then I could be unapologetically who I am. And it shifted so much in the way that I operated in the world. So before, I used to, like, you know, if I had to give a speech or talk to people, I would get all nervous. I'm like, what am I going to wear? Am I going to sound smart? Am I going to, you know, be logical? And now I can just talk. And it's so freeing to just be able to talk and speak from my soul, speak from my heart. And that's what's now, you know, I'm making this work a lot more enjoyable than it was when I was pretending to be somebody that I really wasn't.
Wow. That's a whole word. Brenda, what are some of your values?
That's a good question. I actually spent a year and a half in a program where the work was to identify what your core value is. I resisted because they wanted me to find one core value. And I'm like, we're far more complex than that. But the one that ultimately I landed on as my core value was justice. And that's been kind of the thing that I think when I look at who I am personally and professionally has been consistently through everything that I am. So that's the core value. I've got other values though that I think shape me who I am. And I didn't get them in my Western education and training. I realized that I got them from my culture, from my parents, and from my religious beliefs. And I lost all of that through the training that I got as a lawyer. And I had to go back and go through a journey to refine them. And now I have them. Now I can lean heavily into them.
Yeah.
Where are those roots for you, Brenda? I mean, I heard you mention your family background and your cultural background, your religious. Like, could you name specifically what they're bringing in for you?
So my parents are from Guatemala, and because they immigrated when I was a baby, I lost that connection, right, to being from that country. And as an adult, I got an opportunity to go back. I learned in that travel and in those journeys that Mayans were extremely intelligent. They were scientific. They were doing medical practices. They were so far advanced from anybody else in the world at that time. And so this sense of power and unlimited ability to reimagine and think like I didn't know I had, but I was able to capture in that moment when I was like, wow, these are the people I come from, right? Because the narrative I had been given is like, you're an immigrant, you come here, you're not helpful, you're not adding yes. value. And so I was fighting against being an immigrant. And then I got to Guatemala and I'm like, oh my God, I'm Mayan. And I have all these things. So there's some of that. I think not too long ago, someone was asking me, like, who's been influential in your life, Brenda? And I shared that the principal of my high school, even today, I think sits on my shoulder. Mm. And she was an Irish Catholic nun, which is not who you would imagine someone like me would be inspired by, right? But here's the thing. She broke all the rules of what you think about when you think about an Irish Catholic nun. And what I mean by that is she ran a high school in the Mission District in San Francisco, and she never turned away a girl because she was pregnant. And she never turned away a family from being able to go to school because they didn't have money. And she always created opportunities for those of us in that school to see ourselves as possible leaders, as possible presidents, as possible scientists. And she fought whenever there was any narrative that was limiting us as mostly immigrant, poor, you know, youth. And so in her, I learned the social justice component, right? That's where my core value comes from. And she was such an instrumental player in my life at a very formative point. And so she's connected to religion because I was raised Catholic, but Catholic and in an alternative anti kind of your traditional Catholic things. And so that really resonates. And then from my parents, I get the notion of, you know, unlimited possibilities. They came here not knowing English. They came here not knowing anybody. And they created a life and created opportunities for me and my siblings to do amazing things in this world. And I'm just like in awe of them, because how many of us would do that, you know, and the courage that it takes to do that, the confidence. And so when I look at that, I'm like, if they did that, then Brenda, you can do anything, right? So those are some examples, Chanel, of how that culture and family and religion have played out in bringing those values out in who I am.
Thank you for laying that beautiful foundation. I mean, it just clarifies so much. And that's not the first time we've heard two people reaching back to their ancestral roots to find strength, to find a way to go forward, right? Imagination, freedom, right? So that's really beautiful.
And I think it's also beautiful to think that although the situations in which I came to this country are significant, potentially significantly different than your family, I'm part of that lineage. I'm part of those folks that left everything and came to this country and made a life. So I feel that connection, and I honor what it takes to do that. And I'm reflecting just in how, I mean, you already laid out so much inspiration and so much grounding in terms of all of these callings for you to be authentic and to do whatever you wanted. And we go into, once we start to go into professional spaces, this is at least what happened to me. you start to lose that part of yourself. And I think for us as immigrants, it's different from different for different communities, but I'm going to speak from the eye. I think being an immigrant, you think you just have to follow because you're not from here, which is kind of one of the most powerful things around about the patriarchy and about modernity and capitalism, that it makes you the other. And because most of us are other, then we feel like we just have to like come to this one way of doing things. So we spend part of our careers just thinking that we have to comply. So I'm just curious to hear from you. What was that like for you? And what was the spark, the situation, the moment when you were like, wait a minute, this is not working for me. And how was that process for you?
Yeah. So Ephraim, I spent a lot of time trying to fit in. And I didn't learn that I didn't have to fit in till I was in my mid-40s. So I want to share that because that's context. That's how hard it is to break, you know, the chains of what you've been taught and what is around us in this mainstream environment. In some ways, it was good because it gave me an opportunity to continue to move up in my career. But in some ways, it was not good because it took away who I was. The thing that really changed is that I had been in philanthropy for about 15 years. Felt like nothing was changing because of all the work that I was seeing being done in the foundations I worked at. It felt like we were playing a game with nonprofits, and it didn't feel like it was worth doing this work anymore. And so I had this moment, and you know, my husband would tease me and say, "You're having your midlife crisis, Brenda." And I'm like, "No, I'm having this moment of like, what do I do next? Because I've done the legal stuff, can't fix it that way. I've done the policy stuff. That's maybe where there's the most potential, at least from where I was sitting at the time. And this philanthropy thing is just like, what am I doing?" So at the time, I thought I was going to go back to policy and advocacy work, because it felt like that, at least I was the closest where I had been to who my authentic self was. And then I got to go to this leadership program where, you know, we identified our core values. And the next step of doing this program was to begin to map out, all right, what do you want to do with the rest of your career? And both on a personal and professional time frame. And it was the first time that I gave myself permission to stop being in the frenzy of the work and say, mm-hmm. what do I want to do? Mm-hmm. Who am I? What are my core values? If I have X number of years left in my career, what's the best use of that? And that program was a year and a half long. And I think we never stop. Like those of us who do this work, we don't stop. And so how do you create the space, right, for us stop and reflect and figure this out? So that was a transformational moment, right? It was more than a moment, but that was the thing that got me to begin to ask the question of like, how do I get to more meaningful work? How do I become more authentic? And in that process, I think I also gave myself the freedom to dream.
Yes.
Because I was always busy doing. I was always busy meeting deadlines. I was always busy in the performative culture that I was a part of. Yeah. And so to have a space to dream. And that whole year, I just spent sitting with the question of, what if philanthropy was different? What if we flipped the paradigms that we have? What could that look like? And I started journaling and started outlining, like, I'd get rid of this, I'd do that, I wouldn't do this. And all of a sudden, I ended up with this opportunity of like reimagining philanthropy in a way that was not like anything that I had done. And sometimes in life, when you open up those possibilities and engage in that kind of positive space, maybe a spark space, things happen. And so for me, it was a headhunter came and said, "Do you want to go run this new foundation in Montana?" And I said, "Absolutely not initially." But then when I got an opportunity to talk about this is what philanthropy could look like differently, and I had an audience that engaged, it was just like, go. And I think I never would have imagined that this would have happened to me in a place like Montana, because it never happened in California for me. But here I got to go to Montana and completely reimagine what a foundation can look like, how it does its work, how we see power, how do we create trusting, authentic relationships. And that was the free moment, right? So like my life has been full of joy professionally since I've been here. And it's what has kept me in philanthropy. I think if I have to go work in another place that takes me back to prior to my headwater years, I don't want to be there. I don't want to go there.
How is that philanthropy looking different? Like, can you tell us how it feels and how it looks like for you? Like, what have you built?
Yeah, I think in philanthropy, traditionally, you know, the written word, the expertise, the ROI, the bureaucracy are all things that are pretty standard in philanthropy. And so I said, well, what if instead of having an expert decide what we fund or who we fund, what if instead of having our board decide that, we actually flip that and gave the power to community? So Headwaters, our whole strategy and all of our priorities and everything we do come from a series of what I describe as 600 cups of coffee up and down Western Montana, talking to anybody that would talk to me, from teenagers to hospital CEOs and everybody in between, and taking all that and saying, this is what the community said they want us to do. And this is what they want us to focus on. So our whole strategy is not top down, it's bottom up. And that's different. How we think about what the value add is of what I describe as the rigmarole of philanthropy, right? So like there's RFPs and LOIs and due diligence and write-ups and dockets, all these things that are part of, you know, traditional practice. What if you got rid of that? And so we don't have any of those things at Headwaters. What we instead have is we know what community said they want us to fund. We go out and have conversations with leaders in community and with, you know, even anybody actually who'll talk to us. And we find sparks, not to keep coming back to my word, but we find sparks of amazing things that are happening. And then we say, let's give you money. And we don't make them apply to us. We listen to what is it that you're doing? What is it that you need? And then we come back and we enter that into our grants management system and we award them a grant. So they don't have to actually apply to us. Another example is we've automated a grant-making program here at Headwaters, where the theory is like this. If you are mission-aligned and you are doing this work in Montana, in the regions that we fund, and you've been operating for at least 3 years, we should be supporting your work. We don't need to know anything else. And guess what? We can find all of that on existing databases. And so we just ask people, put in your mission statement, tell us your zip code, give us your IRS determination number, and then our system runs. And if it's check, 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 we can approve within 24 hours of them giving us that information and get a check out to them in a week. And by the way, the grantees we've had through this program are doing amazing work up and down Western Montana. Nobody's stolen money. Nobody's like done something awful. We're having impact, and we don't need 6 months of due diligence time, and we don't need an internal review committee, or we don't need board sign off on these things. So this is just some few examples, right? Mm-hmm. The idea right now for me is like, let's look at everything we do in philanthropy and could we do it differently?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Brenda, it's an incredible body of work that you have and an inspiration. I remember the first time that we met, I still worked at a large foundation, Kresge Foundation, and I think I maybe was moderating a panel that you were on. This was CEP, Center for Effective Philanthropy, and they do their own panel design, or at least they used to, and then they would ask people to come be on it. And I think they'd asked me to moderate one about moving toward trust. So maybe the very beginning, early mutterings, if you will, around trust-based philanthropy. And the other thing that I have seen many times over and we talk about is that the asset size of your organization often has a lot to do with the kind of platform that people have or how people perceive influence. The work that you are doing and the way that we are watching people watching headwaters, that math is different. And it is a really beautiful thing to see. It's my observation that your voice, that your influence, that what you are doing at Headwaters, you, your team, your board, that people are watching and paying attention. And that isn't the way that a lot of philanthropy has operated, to assume that folks want to come out to Montana and see what's happening there.
No, it's a great observation, and I would have to agree with that. You know, we have had people come and visit from different parts of the country. So for sure, people are watching, and we're a small foundation relative to, you know, other foundations. But we have been able to build a voice out in the field. And I think on different things, you know, everything from the way we evaluate to the way we grant make to the way that we center community and seek power. So I think it's resonating. And for me, it's resonating because people are asking the question post-pandemic and post the racial reckoning stuff of traditional stuff has not worked. So what could we do differently? And I think there was this sort of magical moment of, I came to Headwaters right before the pandemic. We were just rolling this out. Trust-based philanthropy was becoming a thing. And so then there was this perfect moment, right? This window opened up for this to take off. And so I think people have been watching and are curious. It does make me wonder, you know, I didn't think about all this in Montana. I did it when I was in California. Mm. And I did it when I was working for large foundations. And I've been, you know, this is all built upon things that I've tried at previous foundations. Mm-hmm. So I do sometimes wonder, like, why wasn't I given the chance to do this in California? Why did I have to come to Montana to do this? What was different? And then the other thing I hear, Shira, is, well, Headwaters gets to do that because it was brand new and you got to shape it from the beginning. Or Headwaters mm-hmm. is small and mm-hmm. that's why you can do that. Or you don't have a long history of, we've been doing things this way, and changing that is really, really challenging. And I think I have to differ with those perspectives, because mm-hmm. I think it's about vision and leadership and courage to move people to do it differently. And that can be scary, but when you've found your authentic self, I stop caring about what people think and just do what I think is right. And I think that the way that we work at Headwaters can be done at any foundation as long as there is the desire and leadership and vision to do it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, the vision, leadership, and courage. I mean, that's right on. And I agree with you. I wholeheartedly, I see it. And I mean, it's your work is really exemplary. I honestly can't say it enough.
Mm-hmm. Well, I appreciate that. And I always get like, this is where I get, you know, embarrassed, because I don't see myself that way. I like to talk about, like, all this work is common sense. It's using good values, using good judgment, being good people. Like, if we all did that,
yeah,
what kind of world could we possibly have?
Exactly. Right. It's just about being human.
It's not rocket science, right?
No, it's not. I'm not brilliant. I'm not anything. I'm just like using common sense to do the right thing. Mm. And to see everyone in the ecosystem, right? I think that this notion of that I think often gets lost when we're talking about trust-based philanthropy, that it's really about seeding power. It is a really big element of this, of seeding mm-hmm. power internally, mm-hmm. externally. Mm-hmm. And when you can finally get to a place where you're confident in who you are, and you don't have to be in that performing kind of stance, yeah. then you can be more comfortable seeding power and letting other people lead and drive. I myself haven't done this at Headwaters, right? It's been our grantees, it's been our board, it's been our staff mm-hmm. that have been part of this.
You talked really powerfully about the year and a half long program that you participated in and all the things that you unlearned, relearned, and what you stepped into as a result. And you shared with us that the capacities were always there. The values were always there. The lineage, right? The experiences. So for people who are listening and are, you know, wondering, like, what might you say about some of that personal work? Like how might people quicken or move toward what it will take to open up their vision, their courage, their leadership from wherever they are?
I think it's important for all of us to find space to stop. Stop from the craziness of the work and create those spaces where we can sit and reflect, which is why I appreciated framing the question at the beginning of like, what word have you been reflecting on? I think we don't spend time kind of sitting back and reflecting. And that can look a variety of different ways, right? It could be sitting and journaling. It could be meditating. It could be having conversations like this one or listening to conversations like this one that open up the possibility of different, of alternatives, of innovation. So that's the first thing. It's like stop and create those spaces where you can reflect. The second one is to really stop and think about what are your core values. You don't need to go through a program to figure that out. You can sit and figure that piece out on your own. And then how do you use that core value to make decisions personally and professionally? Because I think we often identify values or say we have values, but do we really use them in how we are operating in the world? And I would say until I got and found my core value, I didn't. I think people would ask me, what do you stand for? What do you believe in? And I could talk generically about a bunch of stuff. But now that I know what my core value is, I can use that lens. And every time a decision comes in front of me, I can say, well, how does that fit within my core value? Or how does that drive towards the things that are my core value? And then the other thing is to really spend time looking inwardly, which is probably part of reflection.
Yeah.
Because I think I had this in my soul. I had this inside of me. I just didn't know it was there. And so how do you give yourself permission to go there and let your soul be the thing that really drives what you're doing and what you're focusing on? There's a piece of paper I hang in my office. Everywhere I go, I've had it in different offices. And it is a poem that was given to me. It's written by John O'Donohue, and it's called To Bless the Space Between Us. Mm-hmm. And the very end of this poem says, may integrity of soul be your first ideal, the source that will guide and bless your work. And for me, that, if people can tap that and use that to be their guide, I think you can get to be your authentic self.
Yeah.
Awesome. Right. Thank you, Brenda. Thanks for spending this hour with us. Amazing.
Absolutely. Brilliant. I loved it.
Yeah, I think this is just another one where I think Brenda is a great exemplar of the underlying process we're trying to excavate with this podcast. And so I'm glad that we had her on.
I completely agree. I think it's just what I said in front of her, it's exactly what I think. I think it just fits into what we're talking about, what it means to grow in public, what it means to do things for the right, be in the right relationship with why you do things.
Yeah. Definitely there's notes on the need to take space, right? Space to dream, space to imagine. For Brenda, there was also this finding who she was. For her, that was digging into her background, her ethnic background, and finding strength and support and inspiration in that, you know? So that might be a part of the praxis too. Like finding where your roots are, where are you calling in your energy from, right? And identifying those sources and really plugging in. And so I love that about her story. I love that the leadership program was, in this case, the proxy for that space, right? And she did all that imagining, and it took time, and she had to think through what her values were. I like that she said that her values weren't self-evident either, right? So I'm thinking about all the people that are just operating on autopilot, in the organizations following the rule, right? Following the rules, and they're not centered in anything specific, right? They're not centered in anything deeper, right? And so this is also a call for people to get engaged deeper in their work, in personal and professional, right? And actually have it linked, not only for, you know, bringing big ideas to the playing field, but just for your own satisfaction, right?
And patient, right? I would hope that, like, from both the interview with Brenda and the interview with Crystal, that folks would hear that becoming is lifelong, and that we have to allow ourselves some patience with ourselves and some grace, because we can hear young Brenda in high school was pretty incredible. Crystal has always, it says in the headline about her retirement, been a step or two ahead of the pack. But we might see them only in their, like, sort of in the moment of their leadership today. But when we hear their stories, right, a bit more about what it took and really what it continues to take, like, it's an invitation for all of us to be patient with ourselves, to allow ourselves grace. And also in that patience, it's not to not start or not move in that, but to be patient with ourselves as we go. But we have to go meaning stop or slow down sometimes, but like we have to be in it. And the praxis actually needs us now, right? Needs us to try it, to be in it now.
To learn more about the work we do, how to get involved, and get free, go to freedomdreamsphilanthropy.com.